Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Welcome, everybody. Mary Feinberg used to tell her husband of more than 40 years that she would be the first one to pass away. She, with her poor immune system and skill at catching colds, she didn't expect to survive her marathon-running yoga enthusiast spouse, Paul. But in 2017, Paul passed away. In life, some of the time Paul wasn't spending being active or as his job as a psychoanalyst, he spent avidly investing in the stock market. So after he passed, Mary was left not only to mourn, but also to handle her finances and figure out what to do with all these investments. Mary's story is striking many in many ways for its commonness. Those who have lost a spouse or a loved one will likely be able to sympathize with the realization of how emotionally and financially interwoven Mary and her husband's lives were. Mary told her story to writer Andrew Goldman as part of the Money Diary series for the investing service Wealth Simple. Back in November, we had Andrew on the show, who's also a contributing editor at the Wall Street Journal magazine and host of the podcast The Originals. We talked about that series called Debt a Love Story, about a couple struggling through debt. This piece is about Mary, and it's called Loss a Love Story, and both Mary and Andrew join us in studio. Thanks for coming down. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And for folks who are listening at home, as you're listening along, you're thinking, gosh, I might be in a situation like this, or I want to figure out what the best thing to do is. In the second half of this segment, we're going to be talking to a financial advisor named Tom Fredrickson. So if any part of the story reminds me of your own, or if it spurs any questions, be prepared to call us, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. So Andrew, what made you want to tell a story like this about a couple who'd been together a long time and then had to deal with one of them passing?
We're telling a lot of different narratives about couples, and I feel like one of the things that people don't talk about much publicly is finances. And this, I think, is a situation that people really don't talk about. I mean, the two issues, both death and finances, are so taboo that I think people are often blindsided when something like this happens. I mean, it happened in my own family. My father, we assumed, would die long before my mother. My mother just dropped dead over a weekend, and she was the one that took care of all the finances. And all of a sudden, the family had to deal with something that we didn't think we were going to have to deal with and figure out these accounts. My father had no idea what to do. So I went looking for somebody who could tell me a little bit about the situation of having a spouse who handled all the finances of the family, and then all of a sudden wasn't there one day. And not only is somebody thrown into this period of loss and mourning, they also have to deal with the banks. So I thought Mary's story was super compelling. And Mary is such a sort of wonderful storyteller and so candid that, I really, really appreciated what she told us and how candid she was about her own experience with her husband, Paul.
So Mary, how would you describe the way that you and Paul handled your finances?
Well, he did all the investing. I paid the bills. And I would listen to NPR, and you'd hear stories on the news about new products that were coming out, new whatever. I would tell him, hey, there's this new battery coming out. Maybe you should check it out, see if it's good. He would, and sometimes he would say, oh, yeah, it's good. I'll invest in that. Or he would say, no, I don't think I will. And he did all of his own investment. He did it through a company, but he did it himself. He didn't have somebody else do it for him.
Was he someone who enjoyed that?
He loved it.
Yeah?
He loved it. In the morning, he'd get up, he'd have his coffee, sit down with his computer, and look at everything, the stock market, and this and that and that. Now, that, I still don't understand all that up and downy and stuff and all the stuff. He did love it. He liked it.
So many people think of their biggest investment as their apartment or their house or their home, but you've got that unicorn in New York. You've got a rent-stabilized, gorgeous, big apartment. Tell people a little bit about it and then how some people might have actually seen your apartment.
Oh, okay. All right. So many, many years ago, our apartment was used in a movie called 9 1/2 Weeks. And then the same director came back about 2 years later and used us in Fatal Attraction, used our apartment in Fatal Attraction. He liked the long hallway. He's up in the apartment. So
you folks were lucky in New York to have a rent-controlled apartment. So you didn't really have real estate in your portfolio,
no,
right?
No, we were rent-stabilized. Yeah. Right. No. We never owned any property, that kind of thing. Yeah.
So as you were looking at what you needed to deal with financially, what was the biggest confusion for you? What was the head-scratcher?
Passcodes.
Passcodes, yeah.
I'm telling you right now, that was the worst. My oldest grandson, my daughter, both my daughters, and one of my daughter's husbands spent hours looking at the little 3x5 cards that my husband had made with the different passcodes on them. Unfortunately, when he made a new one, he didn't cross out the old one. So we were like, I am not a computer wizard, so I don't know. So they spent hours trying to figure out the passcodes. Once they did that, then we were good to go. That was probably the worst part.
Can I tell you, I had a situation where we always thought in our family that my dad would outlive my mom because he had an aunt who was 107 and his mother, but he didn't. And he had pancreatic cancer. And I can remember, and we know that how that ends, and it ends quickly. And I can remember on the second or third day, I asked him for his passwords.
Oh.
And he looked at me funny, and then he said, "That's my girl." Because I realized, like, oh my gosh, because he took care of all the big finances, and I realized, oh gosh, I'm going to have to do this with my mom, and wow, what is this going to be?
Right.
It's interesting that you're calling this series, Andrew, a love story. Why do you call these love stories?
Well, this one I think is a classic love story. I mean, Mary told me all about how much she loved Paul and how he reminded her of Serpico when they first met, when she first saw him.
Oh, he was good looking.
True.
Yeah, very good looking. And, you know, they're all love stories. And I feel love is frequently entwined with finances. For me, personally, I feel somewhat starstruck being in the same room with somebody who actually lives in the apartment that stood in for Michael Douglas's apartment in Fatal Attraction. And was the scene of... Was it a scene of any of the love scenes in 9.5 weeks?
No, it was the apartment that the female character lived in.
I'm sorry
where Mickey Rourke lived.
So, I mean, you know, these are all, you know, people, love and finances are frequently entwined and frequently affect each other. I mean, people often say that, you know, the biggest problem in relationships is money. And the biggest thing that people fight about and talk about and worry about is money. So, you know, I think for Wealthsimple, it was sort of a no-brainer to talk to people who are in love, very frankly, about their money.
Mm-hmm. What do you hope your readers get from hearing about Mary and Paul's story?
Well, Mary's story, I think, is probably the best case scenario, which is the worst thing that you can say is that the worst thing that they had to go through was finding passcodes. I mean, there are many couples. I'm talking to actually a couple that perhaps we'll talk to later on in your show, but couples who deal with unexpected debt when a spouse dies, that all of a sudden they realize they're hundreds of thousands, if not millions, in debt. Mm-hmm. Mary was lucky enough to be in a situation where her husband invested really wisely, but she was put in a situation where not only did she have to find these passcodes, I mean, she had somebody who was what they call an active investor. He was somebody who was invested in specific stocks. And then all of a sudden, Mary is here knowing nothing about the stock market. She's got to sort of rejigger her finances and find out and you know, perhaps go into things that are more passively managed or have somebody manage her money, which, Mary, did you go through that?
Yep, yeah. But I did, I don't know if I say the name of the firm or not, okay?
Totally up to you.
All right. Paul would always say to me, even before he was ill, he would say, what will you do if I die? Well, you ain't going to know anything about it. And I said, well, he that invested through Charles Schwab.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, well, the Charles Schwab people are so nice. I said, I'll just take all the stuff there and talk to them. And that's exactly what I did. And with the help of my son-in-law, we sat down with the people from Charles Schwab. And now I'm what they call a private client, and they help me with the investing. They don't do anything unless I say it's okay to do it, but they fill me in on what it means, and they're terrific.
Was there something that you had hoped that you and Paul maybe had had a conversation about that would have made this experience easier for you?
I don't know. I mean, I was an English teacher. Math is my worst subject. So I don't know. Except that I do, as I said, I listen to the radio. I would read the newspaper about things that were happening in the world, where he didn't always have time to do that, but he would have time to look up what the ups and downs of things were. And I came from a family where people invested. And so I knew that investing and being in the stock market was good, and that you couldn't have a nervous breakdown if the market went down a little bit. You just had to hold tight, and you never, never, never used money that you needed to pay a bill with.
That's
never.
Wise.
Never.
That's conservative in a good way.
Yeah.
I wanted to add something to what Mary has done so many things so well, and she went into a very reputable place to have her money managed. Older folks, especially older folks who don't handle the finances, are frequently big targets for not even scams, but if you go into many of these banks that you see all over New York and you just ask them to manage your money, they will put you in things that are so larded with fees, and
or they'll also try to absorb all your money into their particular product.
Well, their particular proprietary products is what they call them. And frequently, if you go into X Bank, they'll put you into X Bank. Oh, you had that happen. Everybody has this happen as a young person.
But to help somebody.
But what people don't understand is that if you go into a bank and people seem very nice and they say this is going to be the best thing for you, they don't actually have to invest things in what's going to actually do best for you. They will frequently invest things in what's going to be best for the bank, which is lots and lots of fees. I mean, there are specific products that are marketed to seniors, like annuities, which are really famous for being, you know, so larded with fees that you'll never make any money on them, and something called a non-traded REIT, which I've been told if anybody ever tries to sell you a non-traded REIT, and this is something they market specifically to seniors, you're supposed to run in the other direction.
All right. Well, ask Tom about that, too.
Ask
Tom about it when you come in. Mary, I want to tell our listeners we're talking to Andrew Goldman and Mary Feinberg. Mary is the subject of Andrew's piece, which is Loss, a Love Story. And Mary's being very generous by sharing her family story with us. When you were going through the mourning period, I know when I went through this with my mom, can you describe what it's like to have to think about these things, but also then think about Paul not being there?
Okay. Well, the hardest part was he was a psychologist, psychotherapist, psychoanalyst. And so we had to close his office. We had to get the furniture out. We had to, you know, do things with it. And we had to contact his clients, which my oldest grandson did beautifully using the computer. There were so many things to do that actually mourning Paul was the last thing on my mind at that particular point. And it was only months later that I started feeling sad. Because then I said, well, okay, we did all this with everybody's help, not just me, please. But then I realized, oh, I open the door at night and I go in the house and he's not there.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the hardest part after taking care of everything. There was so much to take care of. But then you realize now the mourning has started. Actually, 2 years after his death, it feels worse.
Yeah, you know, you get very involved in the, especially because I can tell you you're a get things done kind of person and getting things done. And there's just sort of you're feeling sort of like, this is the way Paul would have wanted for me to take care of things.
Yeah.
This is what would have happened. My parents would have wanted me to take care of these things.
Yeah.
And it does hit you a little bit later. Do you feel like you're in a sound place financially? You feel comfortable? You feel like this is okay?
Yes. Yeah, no, I do feel really, that's good. That's good. I was a teacher, so I have a pension and I have Social Security. And so it's good.
Are you having conversations with your children about what happens next? given what you've gone through?
Yeah, well, I made up a whole folder with everything.
You're very organized.
Right. And have a really very lovely accountant who lives right in my neighborhood a block away. And she helped me make up a will and do all these other things, you know. And so it's great. So, yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah, but that's important because I want the girls to know what to do. Because even though I don't have a business of my own, there's still a lot of stuff you got to take care of. So, yeah.
You want to add something, Andrew?
Well, I just wanted to say that I got two queries when I filed this piece. Neither of my editors could believe that not only the morning that he died, any morning, Paul did 278 push-ups. Is that could that possibly be?
And absolutely.
Did they fact check you on that?
They did. Can you imagine 278
You could
push-ups?
See that because he kept a notebook with how many push-ups he did, what he did, you know, for his exercises. And so he did, I think it was 278 push-ups on the morning of his death. And he put it in his notebook and...
I mean, I think this is an example of how fragile life is, that somebody could do 278 push-ups on a morning and then just be gone in the afternoon. So,
From your reporting, what is the biggest obstacle to having these conversations, especially around death and loved ones and spouses and partners?
In my experience, everybody wants to believe that they're immortal. And everybody has these sort of preconceived notions of the order of deaths. You had it. Mm-hmm. Mary had it. I had it. I think that there is, we all make these plans. And then what's the line about it? God laughs.
Why are you making men plans and God?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I feel like people try to choreograph how things are going to happen and they have absolutely no say over what's going to happen. And frequently situations like this, Mary, again, was very lucky, but, I've spoken to people who were really, really surprised by what a spouse has left. And it's not always good news.
So, Mary, if we've got somebody who's listening, one of your fellow WNYC sustaining members, thank you, by the way.
Oh, my pleasure.
What advice would you give someone who's in your situation, maybe one of our listeners is?
Well, I would say to, if you're in the stock market, don't get crazy if the stock market goes up or down, because it does that. As I said previously, don't use money that you need to pay a bill with. It's not lotto, it's not like that kind of thing. And then find yourself a good advisor, somebody to help you. Not necessarily a big bank as you were talking about before, but some good organization for whom it is important for you to do well. And where they get a very small percent of money from their salary, to help you out to do that. And if you need help, if I don't understand something, I can pick up the phone, I can write an email to them, and they respond. They're terrific. They're just the best. They're just great.
What made you say yes to Andrew's story?
Well, my daughter knew him. knows him. And I said...
So you're vetted.
Yeah, right. I said, okay. I said, all right. I said, I don't know. All right. So we'll get... All right. So, yeah.
I knew Mary because only because I'd seen her in several of her daughter's films. Mary's actually not only a teacher, but she was a gifted actress, and she and Paul were both in Shana's films, and she's like fantastic.
Oh, well, that's a whole other segment. You'll have to come back for that.
Right.
I would, if there's just a second, I would like to add, Paul was a really incredibly skilled investor. What people sort of frequently don't understand, and at Wealthsimple I've done a lot of research on this, is people generally fail when they pick specific stocks. And I think that you might want to talk about this a little in the segment after. Generally, diversification is much better than picking individual stocks. I mean, Paul was lucky. He managed to get Apple early. But, most people... Well, you'll only hear stories of people like buying Amazon in 1997 and turning like $200 into $10,000. But frequently you don't hear about people losing, and it's very easy to lose in the stock market.
Good advice. We're going to have more coming your way. First of all, though, I do want to thank Andrew Goldman and Mary Feinberg. The piece is called Loss, A Love Story. We have linked to it on our Twitter That's all of it, WNYC. Thank you so much, both of you, for coming
in.
Thank you. It's good to see you again. If you have a story you'd like to share on the air, or perhaps one similar to Mary's, or you just have a question, we have a financial advisor coming on in, Tom Fredrickson. He'll be live in the studio next. Our number is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. We look forward to your call. Stay with us. Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We're joined now by Tom Fredrickson, a financial advisor and founder of Fredrickson Financial Planning. For the rest of the segment, we're going to be taking listeners' calls on questions you had. Maybe you heard Mary's story and you're in a similar situation. Maybe what struck you about it? Does it remind you of your own experiences? Our number is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. So, Tom, for someone, for a spouse or a loved one, after they pass away, how much time can someone take to grieve, or are there things that need to be done right away?
Well, that's a great question. I think finances is probably the last thing people are thinking about at a time like that. And I think people really need to take time to grieve, to kind of deal with the situation, and there's generally nothing that's so urgent that needs to be taken care of immediately after a person's passed away. The time to take care of things that are that urgent financially are before you die. And after you die, you got to kind of regroup, and you really shouldn't do anything in a state of distress.
That's a good point. Actually, I was thinking that in terms of you could make a really poor financial decision if you haven't gone through the grieving process properly.
That's exactly right.
So what is something that someone could do right now that's a very simple thing that would make it easier for their spouse or partner after they pass away?
Well, Mary came up with the perfect scenario to describe one solution to a common problem, which is finding passwords and things like that. So, gosh, wouldn't it be great if all of the passwords were available somewhere? I personally use a product called LastPass. There are other products, and there are probably benefits to different ones, but LastPass is the one I happen to use. It has one password, and it contains all your passwords within it, so you log into that one site, and you can access all of your passwords. So if you have something like that, share that with your spouse. That's a way that they can get all of those passwords and make sure they're up to date. And when you click on the appropriate website, it will bring up the website automatically and will log you in. That's one way that one thing people could do. Another, of course, would be just to write down the passwords and update it, possibly keep that with your will. If you feel
That's interesting. That's smart.
If you feel unsafe about having this confidential information in an area that your roommate or something could get at, or your cleaning person, then maybe you could put it in your safe deposit box with a will.
How important is a will?
A will is crucial. If you don't have a will, you die intestate, which means that the rules of your estate will govern how your assets are distributed. And you really want to be in charge of that and make sure that your wishes are addressed properly. It's important for people of all different ages, not just people who are older, people who are younger, people with children. It's especially crucial that it really everybody have a will. Now, for people with children, they'll want to have specifications for who is going to be the guardian of the child, who is going to be the guardian of the child's assets. Usually that's not the same person. And so all of this is critical. So it's very important to have a will for everybody.
What kind of information or what kind of questions or things should you be thinking about putting in one's will financially?
Well, a will should, of course, say who is going to inherit your personal assets, your financial assets. You can make specifications for who will get a particular treasure item and things of that kind. There are other documents that go along with a will as well that should be included, which perhaps would include a healthcare directive in case you're unable to make a decision about your own health and whether you should have a continuation of life in a very adverse situation.
Like a DNR, do not resuscitate kind
exactly,
of.
Exactly, yeah. That type of thing. You can have a personal letter of instruction so that you can even have a funeral that will reflect what your wishes are.
Yeah.
Probably like John McCain did, a more elaborate basis.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot of important things that go into not just the will, but a whole set of documents associated with your demise.
Let's take a couple of calls. We're going to go to line 5. Tony is calling us from Wiretown. Hi, Tony.
Oh, hello there. Thanks for taking me on.
Sure.
My next door neighbor's husband passed away a couple of months ago, and his money was put all over the place. Fortunately, he had a password manager that I managed to break into, so we managed to get to all of her accounts. It's done two things. It's enlightened me to the fact that I ought to really tidy my stuff up for my wife so that if I pass away, she can manage it. But basically, my neighbor's wife has never managed anything of this type. We've got a broker who's taken most of our money and put it into sensible stuff and tried to spread her investments in a good way. But with the recent 3 weeks or so of the market collapsing, she is having absolute conniptions about being in the market. And I wondered if there's anything I can do to try and put her mind at rest. I've tried everything I know, but is there any advice that you can give me on that?
Thank you, Tony.
Okay, well, that's a great question, Tony, and I'm sure one that's on a lot of people's minds.
I'm sure
right
you've
now.
Been fielding those phone calls.
Absolutely.
My financial planner sends out a preemptive letter to everybody like, hey, everybody, settle down.
That's a good and proactive thing to do. Well, one thing people can do is think about what you can do, what you're in charge of, what you can control. You can't control the stock market, but you're really in charge of your destiny in a lot of ways. How much money are you spending? How much money are you saving? How tax efficient are you? There's something psychological about doing things and planning that kind of puts you in a frame of mind that you're in charge of your destiny and you can do things to make a difference. So it's shocking to me, even as a financial planner, how much a small change in spending in retirement can make in the success of a financial plan. So I have some clients who were spending they're very frugal. They're artists. They were spending about roughly $55,000. That was their plan, and then they were a little concerned about the market, to say the least. But they looked in their personal financial habits, and they were able to see they could save $10,000 more and they could actually live on $45,000 of spending. And that makes a huge difference. And not everybody has the capacity to save 20 or 25% of their spending. They had a rent stabilized situation. And but there, you can make changes. You can look at your situation. You can talk to a financial planner.
And control what you can control.
Control right? What you can control, exactly. Now, it's possible that this neighbor was improperly allocated in the first place. Maybe she was taking on too much risk, and that should have been looked at by the broker. And the broker should have steered her into some investments that are appropriate for her risk tolerance. And that's really something all financial advisors virtually will do, is give a client a risk tolerance questionnaire, which determines how they will react psychologically in the event of a market meltdown. Now, filling out a piece of paper is not the same thing as actually experiencing that meltdown. And a lot of people are less tolerant of risk than they really believe they were. So this is kind of a gut check time.
Yeah.
And people should look at this and kind of think of how they felt and where they attempted to sell. So usually the worst thing to do is to sell at the bottom, is sell for emotional reasons. That's generally a very bad idea. So one thing you could do is don't turn on CNBC. Don't check the financial pages.
And you're a
day.
Former business journalist saying
I'm
this.
I'm a former business journalist saying this. I worked at Crain's New York Business for a number of years, so I can tell you put it away. Don't look at it. It's just going to scare you even more. I mean, on CNBC, they have like when there's the bad day on the market. I mean, I can't tear myself away sometimes. I got to admit, bad day on the market, they have like this big red banner. You
know, exactly.
Market decline. Don't, and they have like dramatic
crazy music.
So avoid that type of stuff.
Good luck, Tony. You're a good neighbor. We're speaking with Tom Fredrickson. He's a financial planner and founder of Fredrickson Financial Planning. And we do want to remind you, this is just a very informal reminder, but, you know, this is general advice. It's not necessarily applicable to every single person. So just keep it in mind when you give us a call. Let's talk to Denise. She is on line one in Brooklyn. Hi, Denise.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
So my dad passed away almost exactly a year ago, and two big things came up financially, and we were kind of prepared for them, but not fully. So the first thing is that he didn't leave a will. He died intestate, and he kind of made vague references to what his assets are, but we don't have a full idea, or it took my brother a long time to kind of get access to that information. So that caused a few problems. One, he and my stepmom were never officially married. And so even though they were together for about 30 years, they have two adult children, she has no legal rights to any of his assets. And so that's been a tricky thing to navigate just relationship-wise, but also just hard for her. And she hasn't worked in 29 years. So, you know, she's kind of reeling from that even a year later. And then the second thing is my dad was an immigrant and we have extensive family overseas. So, you know, once we fully kind of work out what his assets are and what to do about them and, you know, if we make any of them liquid, my siblings and I then have to decide what our responsibilities are to our family. And I know that my dad provided support for various things and projects and, you know, emergencies, but I have no idea how much he gave or how he decided to give. And even though I was the closest to him on these matters, I know our family overseas in the way that my siblings don't, I still feel so clueless about so much of this stuff.
Patricia, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. In anything in her describing her situation, was there anything that could have been done in advance so that Patricia and her siblings wouldn't necessarily be in this little bit of a quandary?
Well, of course, the will, again, that's critical to have that done ahead of time so this type of situation doesn't come up. It's all too common, though, that people don't do that. And that's really the most important thing that should be done now. It's a little late now. Yeah. You've got to figure the situation out.
That was Denise, by the way. I misspoke. I'm sorry. It's interesting, couples that have been together a long time and haven't been married, is it just in terms of estates and the way things are, is it better to be married upon death for long-term couples?
Well,
like financially and legally, I'm curious.
Well, if you don't have a will,
then don't have a will.
Yes, it's better to be married. It's always better to have a will, of course, but if you're not married, then the spouse has certain rights. And so it's a complex area that really requires the involvement of an estate attorney to get into the details of the situation. But yes, there are things that can and should be done ahead of time. And later on afterwards, there could be certain states, common law considerations that would apply.
So you might want to check on it if you've been in a long-term relationship and you aren't legally married, where it is in your state.
Yes.
Let's go to Eric from Paterson, New Jersey. He's on line 8. Hi, Eric. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
I'm pretty young. Me and my wife are pretty young. We're in our early 30s, and she got kind of pretty sick when she was in her late 20s. So, you know, we don't really own, like, a house or anything like that, nothing to really, you know, divide up. She, you know, since her disease is terminal, we only have so long. Mm-hmm. I was curious about her 401k because she has money in there. And I know there's, like, if I were to take money out of my 401k, there'd be penalties and things like that. What happens with that? Do I just kind of put it into mine? Do I get it all without tax penalties or?
So, Eric, if I understand you correctly, you're asking about how does one inherit a 401k plan?
Right, correctly. Yeah,
okay.
Correct.
Okay, so There's a couple of things you could do. The one thing you don't want to do is just to take the money out and spend it, because then it becomes fully taxable to you. So what you want to do is called a rollover. So you want that money to be transferred preferably directly into either your 401k, if your employer's plan allows that, or into, since this person is your spouse, you're allowed to put it into your own IRA and have it taken out when you are required to take it out and not before. So the important thing is to keep it in a qualified retirement plan. Oh, so there are many brokers who make their money by convincing people to roll over to an annuity or to other financial products, which cause commissions to be charged. So you need to be wary of that also.
Okay, now is this something else that needs to be in a will?
No. So the retirement plans will pass to the beneficiaries outside of the will. So there's no requirement to include it in the will at all.
Eric, thank you so much for sharing your story, and best of luck to you.
Very much.
Before I let you go, Tom, so we've talked about wills, yes, passwords, yes. Is there anything else someone could do right now that would make it easier for their spouse? Should they have both their names on everything? Should real estate be in both names? What is there anything else?
Well, one thing that struck me about Mary's story is the complexity of the financial situation. Many people don't require very complicated portfolios and involve lots of individual stocks. And sure, you can do some of that in a side account, maybe do some personal speculation if you have the assets that allow you to do that. But for me, for example, most of my assets and my wife's assets are in a target retirement fund, which basically has a set of investments that get more conservative as you get older. Now, right. Most people have this available in their retirement plans. I happen to use Vanguard, which is very low cost. If I pass away, which of course I will, not necessarily before my wife, but mm-hmm. probably, mm-hmm. Then she will inherit a portfolio that's basically self-managing, self-adjusting, and she won't require a lot to do with it. Now, so that's one thing. Now, don't run out and sell everything in a taxable account that has a low cost basis. The Amazon stock you bought 15 years ago. Necessarily, you don't want to sell all that, pay all those taxes. But in retirement accounts, particularly, you can easily put it into a target fund or a life strategy type of fund with a fixed balance. So portfolios don't need to be complicated. And if there are complicated components of it, you could put some instructions together. Hey, take this to so-and-so advisor, have mm-hmm. them evaluate what to sell, what to keep. And that would be one way, additional way to make things simpler and smoother on your passing.
Thank you so much for all this advice. You give some really good tips. And thanks to everyone who called in. We wish you, everybody who called in, good luck and good fortune in the future. Tom Fredrickson, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Stick around. We'll talk about the Golden Globes in a minute. We'll be right back. Listen to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. The word surprising is not often attached to this big splashy award show. Usually the likely winners are clearly telegraphed in advance through media stops and ad campaigns. However, the 76th annual Golden Globes, a little different. It definitely delivered its fair share of surprises and upsets. Hosted by Sandra Oh and Andy Samberg, the films Green Book and Bohemian Rhapsody emerged as the top winners, and a streaming show called The Kominsky Project dominated in the TV category. Joining us now to break it all down is Aisha Harris, assistant television editor at the New York Times Culture Desk. Aisha, we're so happy to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm just going to read this tweet that you, one of your tweets. You said, "That was a show. Sandra Oh was fab. Andy Samberg was charming, even while telling that painfully awkward Black Panther joke. Olivia Colman is Queen, Dick Van Dyke and Carol Burnett must be cherished. I need Jonelle Mose's skincare regimen, etc. So really, what did you think of the show overall?
I thought it was actually a little bit more woozy than the show usually is. This is one of the few award shows that we see where the guests are all drinking. And so there were many cracks over the course of the night where they were talking about how, like, oh, we're boozed up. It's great. Because at the Oscars, you're firmly planted in your seat. You can't really do anything. So it's a much more, like, staid, polite affair. But this year, it also just seemed to kind of drag a little. It wasn't as, like, popping as it can be. It has been in the past. There were no sort of, like, big Time's Up moments and stories like that kind of percolated all throughout last year. So a little woozy, but I still thought that the hosts, Andy Samberg and Sandra Oh, did a pretty good job with their banter and had some standout moments as well.
Yeah, they were kind of interesting. I'll talk about them in a minute, though. I want to talk about Green Book. I had the big eyes about this. Okay, so a lot of people have been very critical of this movie. It's set in the Deep South in 1962. This very talented musician and his bodyguard are going through the South, but it's also been criticized for being kind of white-splainy.
Oh, yes.
About civil rights. what did you think when it started to sweep?
To be honest, I was not that surprised.
Okay.
You know, the Golden Globes, first of all, they are made up of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. They're the ones who vote on it. It's only about 90 journalists, and these are journalists who are at international publications. And they're not necessarily a predictor of the Oscars. And so I'm not so concerned about Green Book being like this big Oscar thing. At least I hope it won't be. But I was not that surprised. Like, this is a feel-good movie. We've seen other movies like this, The Help, you know, Driving Miss Daisy have done well at the Golden Globe. So I wasn't that surprised, but it's still a little frustrating.
Peter Farrelly, who is known primarily as like a comedy director, Something About Mary, mm-hmm. sort of gross out comedies, directed this film. And he made this sort of passionate plea, got the orchestra to pipe down. Let's listen to his acceptance speech.
Tony Vallelonga came from an immigrant family in the Bronx and from a culture that didn't value diversity or individuality. Yet, during that trip with Dr. Shirley, he grew and evolved more than most families do over several generations. This story, when I heard it, gave me hope, and I wanted to share that hope with you, because we're still living in divided times, maybe more so than ever. And that's who this movie's for. It's for everybody. If Don Shirley and Tony Vallelonga can find common ground,
we're going to dump out because he goes on about common ground and we have to listen to each other and it's a kumbaya moment. This morning, Twitter was all over him.
Well, it's not a ringing endorsement for the film. The film has already come under a lot of fire for a lot of things behind the scenes. Don Shirley, Mahershala Ali's character, his family has come out and said this isn't really how their relationship mm-hmm. happened. Like, it wasn't as gung-ho. Like, Don Shirley didn't even really consider Tony to be a friend in the way the movie makes it out to be. And so then to have this sort of the speech where he's just reciting platitudes that, especially in this moment, finding common ground is not really something we can't even do that in Congress. And so it just felt very hollow.
The other surprise was Bohemian Rhapsody, the Freddie Mercury biopic. Rami Malek took Best Actor and it took Best Film. But that's a movie that also has a whole lot of controversy, as they say, behind the scenes, with Bryan Singer, the director, being dismissed for supposedly not showing up. But he also had a lot of alleged misconduct allegations. Is that going to haunt this film?
You know, it's interesting to see, because this morning, actually, Bryan Singer posted an Instagram message where he said, thank you to the Golden Globes for, and it's a picture of him in the director's chair, at least we think it is. You can't see his face, it's the back of him. but it's interesting to see that, because he wasn't thanked at all. There was no mention of him on the stage as they accepted the award. So I can see it sort of bubbling up as the award season goes on. I'm not sure how far it'll go, you know, at the Oscars, but we'll see.
It's interesting, a tweet from Louis Fitrell, who hosts, he's a host on Keep It on the Crooked Media Pop Culture Podcast. He wrote, Bohemian Rhapsody and Green Book are definitely the best movies of the year unless you ask the communities those movies were supposed to represent.
Yeah.
So was the Hollywood Foreign Press tone deaf?
You know, they... there's such a weird voting block. Yeah. Like, just everything in general they do, like, tends to be a little bit different from what we usually see. Like, even just tracking with other awards shows, not just the Oscars, but film critics and everything, they do their own thing. And I think maybe tone deaf is a good way to put it. I mean, the biggest surprise to me was that A Star Is Born. It seems like that was, like, very much in the wheelhouse of what they would celebrate. You know, you've got, like, Lady Gaga in her first starring role on the big screen. You have Bradley Cooper being anointed, whether you believe it or not, as, like, this brilliant first-time filmmaker. And it's flashy, and it's beautiful, and it's lovely, and there's great music. I was surprised that Bohemian Rhapsody won it over, but also Bohemian Rhapsody is about Queen, and a lot of people love Queen.
We're talking to Ayesha Harris, assistant television editor at the New York Times, about last night's Golden Globe Awards. So Glenn Close won for The Wife. She was so good in that film. Like, so much of that movie's internal, and she just, and it's a story of a woman who has basically been ghostwriting her husband's books forever, and he goes to get the Nobel Prize, and he does not treat her very well. We'll just say that. She was attached to this project for 14 years, and she cracked a joke that because of its title, that's why it took so long. Why is her win significant?
You know, I think Glenn Close is one of those underrated actresses in a way.
Underappreciated,
I think, is the right word. You know, she still doesn't have an Oscar yet, which is astounding. And I think one of the things that was really endearing about that moment was that she, like, it seemed like an upset. Like, there were a lot of other really strong performances in that category. It's a very stacked category. And she just seemed genuinely, like, just excited to be there and just grateful. And she gave such a great speech. And
let's take a little listen to that.
Yeah.
Oh, we don't have the Glenn Close speech? Well, it was really great. She talked about women needed to go and follow their dreams and needed to really pursue them. I do want to get Regina King in here. A lot of love for Regina King in the room. She won supporting actress for If Beale Street Could Talk. Why do you think she won?
Because she's astounding.
Yeah.
And I also think she's, you know, we can't just talk about these performances on their own. I think she's earned so much goodwill over her career. Like, mm-hmm. a lot of people might forget, but she's been in our TVs and on our screens for decades now, starting, you know, her breakout into 227, the sitcom in the 80s, to small bit parts in Boys in the Hood, and then, you know,
Jerry Maguire,
so many great movies and roles. And I think that she has earned so much goodwill that part of it is that, but also she just gives a brilliant, astounding performance in Beale Street.
And she challenged herself and everyone in the audience to hire more women. Let's listen to her acceptance speech.
I'm going to use my platform right now to say, in the next 2 years, everything that I produce, I am making a vow, and it's going to be tough, to make sure that everything that I produce that is 50% women. And I just challenge anyone out there who is in a position of power, not just in our industry, in all industries, I challenge you to challenge yourselves and stand with us in solidarity. And do the same.
Let's talk about the TV category a little bit while I have a few minutes left. So streaming dominated. You had Netflix with Best Comedy and Best Actor in the Kominsky Method, Rachel Brosnahan, Mrs. Maisel, Best Actress, Sandra Oh, Killing Eve. Are the networks just out of this game?
You know, for the Golden Globes, yes. And I mean, even the Emmys, I think we've seen this narrative has become sort of, you know, can Netflix and Amazon break through? And I think we're seeing that slowly happening more and more. More so, it seems like, this year than it was with the Emmys earlier. But it's very, to me, the biggest surprise, the welcome surprise, was the Americans winning Best Drama. The Emmys, or the Golden Globes, tend to award shows, you know, within the first year or two of their premiere. You had Atlanta won after its first season and Miss Maisel last year. So to see the Americans in its final season win,
nice.
And to me, like, that is an, like, undeniably great show. So that, to me, they were, like, really on the money with that.
And you brought up at the beginning, we'll end with it, the hosts. There was sort of this overall sense of niceness. Like, we're going to be really nice. We're going to play nice. That was what the whole shtick was at the top, that we're going to insult you, but insult you with nice things. Let's take a listen to Andy Samberg and Sandra Oh.
All right, who we got? Who we got? Well, if it isn't Spike Lee, yeah, Mr. Do the Right Thing. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you who does the right thing. You, as a director, lifetime fan, can't wait to see what you do next. Bam, face.
Brutal.
Destroyed. All right, Sandra, hit him.
How'd you feel about their hosting duties? That's a tough job.
It's so tough. And I think, you know, they stumbled a little bit. There were moments of kind of lows or awkward periods. But overall, they were just really pleasant. Like, Andy Samberg is probably, and they kind of cracked jokes about this, but like Andy Samberg is probably one of the few like straight white men in Hollywood who's like kind of, he has so much goodwill and hasn't found a way to ruin it yet. And Sandra Oh, who also won for Killing Eve last night, was just charming, and seeing her have that moment where she was like, this might all change next year. I'm not kidding. I'm not fooling myself. Like, this room might not be the same as it is, as diverse as it is now, but let's live in the moment. Like, I thought that was a really, really touching, heartfelt moment.
In the last 30 seconds, did anybody get robbed?
Oh, you know, Nicholas Britell was not even nominated for Beale Street. The score,
that's
which
a Shonda.
Is like what?
What? I'm with you. Like what? Yeah. Aisha Harris, assistant television editor of the New York Times. Thanks so much for coming in. Will you come back?
Thank you. I would love to.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. We'll be right back.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.